Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and hopefully today we will have much better sound quality than yesterday, where rain and a change of environment for me made it so that my voice wasn't so good. But hopefully the recording today is a lot better. And I am joined today by two of my colleagues. So we have Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you today?
How's Nick?
Very good. And we have Gabriel Krauser again, who is filling in for Herman, who unfortunately could not join us today. He was our scheduled one. But Gabriel bravely stepped up to the task and is going to give us his insight. Gabriel, how's it?
I'm good. I'm just very disappointed that I can't see an image of you under your makeshift blanket tent.
Yes.
And so I wish all our viewers could, listeners, could see what the plague has done to our recording tech.
Yes, I'm innovating by using a blanket as a studio. We'll see how it works out.
Liberty will not be put down, hey? It's
good. Of course. Nothing stops the good daily news, or the bad daily news in this case. Right, so let's start off, of course, with the first of that bad news, which is that Kasatu and SAFTU are planning a strike this week, I think starting tomorrow, Wednesday. They are calling for the South African government to honor its wage agreement and repeated failures to provide basic services around healthcare and transport. Business Day reported that 1.3 million workers are set to embark on a go slow. They said that they would implement a work to rule principle, a form of protest in which employees do exactly what is stated in their contracts and nothing more. And they also called for Cyril Ramaphosa to speed up the prosecutions of corrupt individuals. They promised socially distanced pickets and motorcades. And one of the I can't remember which union boss it was, but one of them said the success of the strike will be not measured by the number of striking employees, but rather the number of workplaces that will be shut. So I think there's a number of interesting things here. One of them, and I think I'll start with you, Gabriel, is that it looks like there's a bit of a difference here in how Kasatu, at least, is approaching this. I think, as you said before the show, SAFTU is being a bit more aggressive. But Kasatu seems to be going a little bit softer in the strike than usual. Am I seeing things or not?
Yeah, well, I think Kasatu started out looking like it wants to go soft, but it's warmed up as SAFTU has joined in. And just by the way, if both unions got full participation from their membership, that would be almost 3 million employees striking. And remember that South Africa only has about 3 million taxpayers, in the sense that about 95% of the income tax comes from about 3 million taxpayers this year. So, you know, there's really huge potential to disrupt the economy from tomorrow. Kasatu's initial go slow seems to be replaced by a more sort of proactive stay away from work. So that's what they're calling for now. Whereas SAFTU is calling for night vigils starting tonight on Tuesday, and for that to and for their protest action to continue all the way through November. They're going to be starting out with a human chain around the union buildings, to highlight their demand, as Zwelinzima Vavi, the Secretary General, says, our first demand is that the government have bolted out of a signed contract with the public sector. So I think between the two of them, they do look to be there. There have been expressions also from regional managers, regional sort of secretaries general, that they want to disrupt public transport, that they want to disrupt schools, which I think is really outrageous given the incredibly difficult year that students have had. under lockdown conditions. But, you know, the unions seem to really be unashamedly representing a kind of labor aristocracy who has become detached from the basic principle of value add, where you as an employee, your salary is determined by how much value you're adding. And it's they sort of have an ideology of decent work and your salary rather being attached to sort of how important your personhood is, and leaving behind both the unemployed who can't climb into things because they're priced out of labor, and because investors are chased away both by the destruction and the sort of increased labor costs. Let's just remember that according to South African police data, there are on average over the last 10 years, 7 years, there have been 10 public incidents of violence a day. So this country is really no stranger to local level protests. Obviously, a lot of those do not come from unions. They come from citizens.
Service delivery protests and such.
Yeah. Yeah. But a lot of them do come from unions, and the unions tend to have a strong capacity to do violence. And the courts, unfortunately, have made several rulings which make it very difficult to prosecute unions from violent protests, which is illegal and unprotected. In part, there was a very important ruling in either the Apex Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal last year, which found that you cannot ask your employees as a condition for returning to work to say whether or not they were part of a known public violent protest, and if they were there but did not perform violent acts, to explain who did. So that sort of basic precondition of trust, the court has deemed to be not as important as worker solidarity. So that just basically creates a shield for violent action and impunity. So I think it's very distressing, and I think a lot of businesses, I mean, we've lost 2.1 million jobs. The economy has been slashed by 16% quarter on quarter. If you go decade on decade, we are half the GDP that we would be if we stayed on the 2000 to 2010 trajectory. So it's really been miserable times, and this looks like a nice way to make it worse. A nice sounding way.
I think that's exactly right. Marius, this is, of course, why we can't have nice things, isn't it? Is that Ramaphosa doesn't seem to be able to take on the unions. And in fact, the unions are still up to their normal tricks, as it seems.
Exactly. But I think there's also a good way for unions to lose whatever goodwill they still have left over. I mean, as Gabriel's just said, over 2 million people lost their jobs between April and June during the lockdown. And it's quite rich now for unions to go on strike because the government doesn't want to give them their above inflation increases. I mean, this is a time when Cyril Ramaphosa just recently said we all need to pull together. I think it was earlier this week or at the end of last week, said we all need to pull together to rebuild the economy, which is all well and good. But when one of your key allies in the form of COSATU is actually sabotaging attempts to fix the economy, then you've got to ask, what are we actually, I mean, who's standing together to build the economy? And I'm not
I just want to reiterate that the strike is partly in support of Ramaphosa, right? Because it's calling on him to get rid of his enemies in the ANC.
Yeah, Tito Mboweni is enemy number one of COSATU. They've said it clearly. He said he wants a referendum on whether we should be bailing out state-owned enterprises that are corrupt and moribund. And they said, get rid of Tito Mboweni. And they see Ramaphosa as being on that side in that battle of forces.
Mm. But also, it's also another example of where COSATU is protecting its insiders, as Gabriel called them, labor aristocracy. But that's always been a problem in South Africa. It's always been elements of insiders versus outsiders. And COSATU has done all it can to keep the status quo, to keep insiders. I mean, they've made it so that unskilled people are often priced out of the labor market with high minimum wages and so on. And also things like NEDLAC, where wage agreements are binding on a whole sector, no matter what the size of the company or whether they can afford these wage agreements. So this is actually, it's a thing. I mean, I've said this before. So one of South Africa's problems, it's always been big business, big governments, and big labor working together to, screw the little guy. And this is another example of it. This is just big labor again, you know, doing, I mean, it's one day in the history of South Africa's written, people will be looking at this period and thinking, what were these guys doing? Why aren't they some sort of sabotage themselves? Made no sense.
Right.
So
and
let's just...
This is another example, I think, of why we're so skeptical whenever someone goes on, for example, News 24 or something and writes about how Ramaphosa has defeated everything and reforms are down the line, is because the basic balance of forces hasn't changed.
In fact, it's tipping against the genuine reformists' favor. So let's just remember what their basic complaint is. The government did pledge certain wage increases over a period of a couple of years. And that was contingent on it being able to pay for that. And Mboweni's argument was, we don't have the money anymore. Okay, we've checked it out. We looked in the bank account, zero, luto. So no paying you extra money with the money we don't have. And that was the argument. And that's what NUMSA and SAFTU's complaint is. They say we're not getting them. So they might be above inflation. We might be going through a crisis, but it doesn't matter because a promise is a promise. Notwithstanding the fact that promise was caveated. And I think that you must be very cautious of the following point. If they do manage to bring out large support, they say they've got two issues. The first one is that the government is bolting out of its signed contract with the public sector. This is its real complaint at once its major raises. But its second complaint is that it's against corruption. And I think people must be very cognizant of the fact that ordinary South Africans that don't have the time to sift through the news every day and analyze and scrutinize, like ordinary people around the world, often come to espouse positions or espouse institutions that have one idea that they really like, and then another idea that they're like, oh, okay, I suppose I like those guys anyway, so let me support them on that front too. So everyone right now is extremely fed up with corruption. I mean, it's a long-standing story in this country over the last decade, but the COVID corruption has been particularly piquant to the emotions and the hearts and minds of ordinary South Africans. So for unions to get up in front of the media and for the cameras to be on them and the spotlight to be shone and the microphones to blare out the message, we're really against corruption, and we're really trying to help Ramaphosa out to root out the evil pilferers. A lot of people are going to see that and think, oh, wow, that's great. The unions are doing a great thing. And, oh, they say that some corrupt people are actually the ones who are refusing to pay the bills. And who is that? Oh, it's Tito Mboweni. This is how you get thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or potentially even millions of people to backpedal on the position that they were in and become more favorable towards this idea that it's guys like Tito Mboweni that are really the problem, and guys like Cyril Ramaphosa, Zwelinzima Mavavi, Ace Magashule that are actually the solution here. Because even if they have personally made a lot of money or personally there's some question marks around them, at least they're not corrupt in this fundamental sense that they are trying to withhold money from the working poor. Look how generous they are. They're standing on the picket lines together and speaking together. This is the kind of way of manufacturing consent for an oppressive regime that has been tried and tested since unions became political. And that's the worry here, is that the balance of forces is actually tipping against the one last genuine reformer that's left.
Indeed. Maurice, final thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Gabriel's spot on that. The only reformer in the cabinet is Tito Mboweni, and I mean, there's maybe even question marks over him. So, you know, I'm also very skeptical when we get told reforms just around the corner. We've also been told reforms just around the corner since Cyril Ramaphosa became president of the ANC at the end of 2017. And I mean, I don't see any, you know, that there's now and again, there's a murmur that comes from Tito Mboweni or somebody else, but I don't see any reform, and I'm not very hopeful that there will be anytime soon.
To paraphrase Yuri Gagarin, I see no reform up here. Anyway, let's move on to, you know, this one just makes me scratch my head. So the IRR has been running a campaign warning about prescribed assets and the threat to people's pensions and savings if the government decides to begin, you know, coming up with legal ways basically to take your savings and forcibly invest them in what government wants them to be invested in, whether that be state-owned enterprises or some other project. And we pressured a lot of corporates saying, you guys need to step up to the plate and protect your consumers, and you need to make sure that government, you don't just acquiesce to government's demands, that you fight this thing every step of the way. And almost all the companies, the big corporates, the big financial institutions, they said, you guys need to talk to the Association for Savings and Investment, ASISA. You need to go and speak to them because they represent us, and they've already said that prescribed assets is a bad idea. Well, in an email statement, the CEO of ASISA, a guy called Leon Kampfer, said, of the economic plans under discussion to revive South Africa's economy, none are calling for prescribed assets to be used as a solution. Retirement funds would consider investing in well-structured, viable investment projects, Kampfer said. This should not be confused with pumping money into state-owned enterprises. Well, and then he went on to say that ASISA is of the view that the current Regulation 28 provisions do not prevent increased investment in infrastructure. Maurice, let me start with you. Is this as hopelessly naive as it looks?
Yeah, I think so. But also, I mean, there has been some climb back by the ANC. Paul Mashatile recently said that there's not going to be, they're going to step back from prescribed assets as well as nationalization of the Reserve Bank. So I think this is maybe something we, the institutes and perhaps others who've been fighting against prescribed assets, especially people like Magnus Haystack, for example, then it's something you can take as a win. And I think there's maybe one thing, one area we could say maybe the balance of forces was starting to, you know, lean our way. So, you know, maybe it is naive, but maybe it's also, I think, it shows that what pressure can do. And I mean, we've got ASISA and we've got Magda Vichika from Signet to come out and say that they are opposed to prescribed assets. So I think this is a win, and perhaps this is a bit naive coming from Mr. Kampfer, but I think it's overall, I think we can give ourselves a pat on the back, I think.
Gabriel, do you agree?
Yeah, I do, and but I just want to refine the point a little bit. You know, a democracy, from a public participant point of view, there are two aspects to democracy. One is the vote. It's very important to vote when you get a chance to vote for whatever party in a party-based system you think is going to represent your interests best, and protect the rule of law and protect the public purse from pilferers. But there's another side to democracy, which is public participation, which is applying this pressure in the media space, which is petitions, people signing on. And I think we've done a very good job in terms of this and issue of prescribed assets. We should pat ourselves on the back. But ASISA should be joining in that exercise. How does it work? The issue with prescribed assets is that all major investors are strongly incentivized to be uncritical of government, and particularly uncritical of the GEPF, the Employment Fund, the Government Employee Pension Fund, and of the Public Investment Corporation, the PIC, which are the foremost public sort of entities that invest. Because if you, as a private hedge fund or a pension fund, private pension fund, if you want to plant a billion rand in a project and the PIC is going to come in with 13 billion rand, then you know you've got a very strong chance of that project sort of being liquid enough for you to gain something on the swing. Even if the project actually doesn't make a profit, you can pull out before that and know that the PIC will be left to carry the bucket when it turns out to be empty. So it's very nice to do deals with the PIC. And it's very nice to be able to do deals with government directly through its tender process, and have access to it as a client. So government as an effective co-investor and government as an effective client, these are both things that you want on your side. So there's a strong incentive not to complain. And this is what Magda initially started doing. She's a billionaire who runs a very large investment. What all of the rest of the pension fund managers were doing as well. And it's a game theory issue. If only one of them puts their head up and criticizes the ANC's resolution in 2017 at NASREC to institute a prescribed assets regime, if none of them complains about cabinet members talking about investing in real assets like Ibrahim Patel has basically sung the song of prescribed assets in slightly vague language, and lowdown members have been explicit about it, if only one person criticizes that, then they can be frozen out of co-investing with the PIC. see, and they can be frozen out of government contracts, and they can lose money, and they can have regulators go sniffing at them in an aggressive way. So it's going to be a lose for them. But if everyone together stands up against it, then you can stop it. And that's what's happened. Now, the only complaint that I have is that South Africans generally have an issue with not realizing, particularly middle-class South Africans, with not realizing that they can also wield force, that they are part of the balance of forces in exactly the way that's just described by clients of these pension funds complaining to the pension fund managers saying, why are you not making loud noises about prescribed assets? I'm going to pull out my money if you don't. That sends the bucket uphill. From the grassroots, it eventually gets to the people at the top, and then they say, okay, we don't want this, and then the ANC steps back. Without acknowledging that win, I think people don't feel as prepared as they ought to fight that battle again and to seize the forward-going momentum to say, okay, well, now you've complained about that. They've rolled back their desire for prescribed assets. Now how's about we complain about the existing conditions of Regulation 28 or the existing problems with the PIC, with the GEPF, and with our state-owned enterprises, where we are bailing out South African Airways, even though we have heard repeated promises that that's not going to happen. So now we've heard a promise that you're not going to assets, stick to that promise. You're not going to bail out that promise too. It'd be nice to see that momentum gain. And this is exactly what Kamfer stops with his Aziza statement. Instead of saying, look, the ANC was sniffing at prescribed assets and the balance of forces was brought against it by ordinary South Africans complaining, and now we need to congratulate ourselves on that win and take it a step forward, he acts as if it was never on the ANC's mind and that there's no there's nothing to worry about, and so pours cool water on the whole enterprise, blocks the momentum from being built, and therefore makes it easier for the ANC to come and try again in a few months' time, in a few years' time, and to continue in various other ways to funnel hard-earned money into the patronage network.
Maurice, final thoughts?
I also just want to say the timing of this is a bit funny, because the statement went out today, 6th of October, and this whole this Twitter little spat between us and Magna was over 2 weeks ago now, I think, or 2 weeks ago. So I find it quite strange that statements come out now. So, I mean, got to raise your eyebrows a bit about the timing. It would have made far more sense if if the statement came out, you know, around all this was going on or when we did send out these letters. But, yeah, I find the timing of the statement being released today a bit weird.
Indeed. All right, now let us take a journey into the past. So as our CEO, Franz Kronier, reminded us this morning, there were a bunch of stories in 2018 which really made it look like there was going to be a crackdown on corruption. On the 15th of February 2018, the Mail and Guardian published a story titled "Guptas to Finally Get Their Day in Court." This followed reporting by News 24 that said one Gupta brother and a business associate are among those arrested and more arrests are imminent. This is also just following a City Press report that former Free State agricultural head Peter Tebete was arrested in connection with his involvement in a failed dairy farm project. Now, Tebete was the head of department at the time that Mosebenzi Zwane, who is now the minister, who was the minister of mineral resources, was the agriculture MEC in the Free State. And it looked like it was only a matter of time before the net was going to close in on Ace Makashula, as many of these people were allies of Ace Makashula. But as Franz pointed out, that seems to be where the story, at least for the most part, ends. We haven't seen a lot of follow-up since this stuff happened. And once again, it feels like a little bit of deja vu, I must say, when I see, you know, Adrian Bosson writing, Cyril has defeated the corrupt forces at the NEC, which he did, a month or two ago. Gabriel, what's your take on this story?
Yeah, so, I mean, everyone's very excited about the fact that there have been five arrests in connection to the Freda Dairy catastrophe in the Eastern Free State. Okay, well done, five arrests. Each of them posted 10,000 rand bail. Bail was unopposed. That's one way that you can tell that they're not very rich people. They're not very high up. They're not very important. Another way that you can tell that we've got a problem is looking at those 2018 arrests, which were of much higher up people in the state capture inquiry. And yeah, pretty much nothing's come out of that. So we've got seven people arrested in connection with Frieda. We've got the asbestos story doing the rounds, but no real consequences yet to bear. And I think it's a nice moment to just reflect upon the broader performance of Shamila Batoya at the National Public Accusing Authority. So the State Capture Inquiry, the Zonda Commission, one of the crazy things about that is its terms of reference were defined by Jacob Zuma himself. Okay. That commission was not set up by Ramaphosa. It was set up by Zuma, and Ramaphosa didn't change the terms of reference. So the terms of reference are to find all corruption. And so the Zondo Commission could be going on until all of us are long dead. Prosecutions that have followed, well, I've mentioned all six. Then you look at the Nugent Commission, which is into SARS. Nugent made a very that commission was the first one to be completed in 2018. It was the only one to complete very nicely and timeously. And he made a strong recommendation not only that Tom Moyane be fired, but also that Tom Moyane, in connection with Bain, be prosecuted. Bain had been sort of paid fake money. It's, you know, paid to restructure SARS in a way that it actually made it worse, and it looked like there was very strong prima facie evidence of wrongful knowing wrongdoing. Knowing wrongdoing. Is Tom Moyane in jail? No. Has Tom Moyane been prosecuted? No. All that Shamila Batoya has managed to do earlier in 2020, and not that much earlier, was to drop the charges against Johan van Loggerent and the other people in the so-called rogue unit. So she stopped charging the bad guy, the good guys, but she hasn't even begun going after the bad guys. Then you can look at the PIC Commission. We've already talked about how important the PIC is. The PIC Commission was supposed to finish in 2019. Early 2019. Ramaphosa extended it three times. Then the report was leaked by independent media, which is important because Iqbal Survey is indicted by the report. But when it was first leaked, because the presidency had it, but it hadn't been made freely available by Ramaphosa's office to the public, the independent media had a week or two to say, here's both the former CEO, Matjila, and Iqbal Survey. Well, actually, then the report came out and it gave very strong prima facie evidence that Matija did knowingly break the law. Has he been prosecuted in any way? No. So the evidence is there. The independent commissions have gathered the evidence. Has there been prosecutions? No. Then you look at the National Prosecuting Authority Commission, where the two major targets were Nomkhobo Jiba and Lawrence Murebi, who were both very senior members of the NPA. Both were found by the commission to have knowingly lied under oath. That is illegal. You must go to jail for that. Whenever you break an oath, it's an indictable offense. But when you're doing it as a senior member of the National Prosecuting Authority in order to shield people, it's a very serious offense. Have either of them gone to jail? No. So those are our four major commissions of inquiry. One is going to carry on going forever. The other one finished quickly, made a recommendation that hasn't been followed through in 2 years. Another one and the other two took a wee while to be finished, one of them with the help of Ramaphosa's delay tactics, and no one's been brought to book. So I think it's you know, it's all very well to be excited about five people who are getting arrested and posting 10,000 rand bail, but when it comes to the mammoth task of rooting out corruption, we are nowhere to be found, unless you watch The Economist, which just released a half an hour documentary yesterday declaring Ramaphosa to be a clean, ethical leader who's got corruption under wraps and is going to lead South Africa into wondrous glory. And if you believe that, then I suppose you must live in London.
Well, after hearing that, I can feel like we're just taking crazy pills here. Maurice, are we taking crazy pills?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you want to give it a charitable reading, I think, you know, we'd say this is some light at the end of the tunnel. But, you know, I won't hold my breath until we see the really big guys getting taken down. The Ace Magashules and the Jacob Zumas of the world, you know. These just feel like these small guys that are being arrested and stuff feel like they, you know, just being thrown as a to the media and to the public, say, look, we're actually trying to do something. But as I say, until we start seeing the really big guys getting arrested who've got real clout in the ANC, then, you know, I wouldn't put too much thought in the president's anti-corruption fight.
The light Indeed. At the end of this tunnel is a steam train, and a track underneath it have already been stolen. So it's careening. It's not even like riding. in a proper fashion. It's just careening. And the only hope is that it will crush under its own weight before it gets to you. That really is the only promise that you have, is that they're so incompetent that they won't be able to steal your money.
Well, I agree with you, Gabriel. I think you have been reading too much Russian literature recently. Anyway, on that note, we're going to call it to a close here. Thank you very much for listening. If you're listening to us on the Daily Friend website, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a review, if you rated us, and if you sent us your feedback. Also, please subscribe to us on Google Podcasts, iTunes, or Spotify. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a wonderful day, everyone.